Welcome to the Gottesdienst Crowd, where we foster confessional integrity, liturgical preservation, and preaching that doesn't stink. We believe that the historic liturgy of the divine service is more than mere cobwebs of antiquity, but it is a true treasure of the church to be dusted off and brought down from her attic to be enjoyed. So let's get dusting.
Welcome back to the Gottesdienst Crowd. This is Jason Broughton, your host. Today we have with us Fritz Eckhart. He is the pastor of St. Paul's Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kewaunee, Illinois, and the editor-in-chief of Gottesdienst. Welcome back, Fritz.
Good to be back, as always.
Yeah, so we are looking at the gospel reading for the 10th Sunday after Trinity. It is from Luke chapter 19, verses 41 to 48, and I will go ahead and read that in the English Standard Version.
Okay.
And when Jesus drew near and saw the city, he wept over it, saying, "Would that you, even you, had known on this day the things that make for peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will set up a barricade around you and surround you and hem you in on every side, and tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you. And they will not leave one stone upon another in you, because you did not know the time of your visitation." And he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold, saying to them, "It is written, 'My house shall be a house of prayer,' but you have made it a den of robbers." And he was teaching daily in the temple. The chief priests and the scribes and the principal men of the people were seeking to destroy him, but they did not find anything they could do, for all the people were hanging on his words. All right, so let's begin kind of with just the context. Is there anything in the context, either immediately preceding or following our text for Trinity 10, that helps us understand what's going on here?
Well, I think there is, especially with regard to this notion of peace, because peace is a big theme in Luke in particular. Okay. And I've always been fascinated by the fact that when Jesus was born, you have, of course, the nativity narrative in Luke, you have the angels singing peace on earth, goodwill toward men. And then comes in this chapter, just prior to our reading, the triumphal entry into Jerusalem and the people singing, and they say peace in heaven and glory in the highest, which I think is a deliberate reference to the song of the angels. And so I don't know exactly what to make of that, but I think it's fascinating because when the incarnation is celebrated, when Christ is revealed in the flesh, you've got the bringing of heaven's peace to earth in the Redeemer, in the one who is and can be called the greater Solomon. And then you have this kind of fleshed out, as it were, in the triumphal entry, which is also the very event is a fulfillment of Solomon's entry into the holy city. And when they sang Hosanna, you know, it's kind of like when the people sang "God long live the king" to Solomon. Mm-hmm. But now it's peace in heaven. So I don't know how we can exactly parse that, but there's something going on where his now the approaching sacrifice, as the Palm Sunday hymn calls it, is ready to make his atonement to bring peace to heaven by this man who is peace on earth somehow. That's about all the best I can do with that. But now that comes up again in this particular reading, the things that belong to peace.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I've always been struck, and maybe you could be able to comment on it and help me through it, is that in the way that Luke has this put together, it's really kind of not a triumphal entry at all, because you have this, you know, the cleansing of the temple and none of the chief people are there welcoming him. So you have, you know, like when Antiochus and when Alexander, when they come to visit Jerusalem, you know, all of the principal people of the land come out to greet them and show him around the city, and none of those people are there. And not only are they not there, they're plotting a way to kill him.
Yeah.
So what's the triumph? And so maybe that has to do with this peace, that he's not saying peace here. They don't know what makes for peace, but it's peace in heaven.
Yeah. Well, there's another thing that we need to talk about in connection with this, and that is a little bit of a translation issue, which may not be a big deal, but I noticed it as I was going through this. And that is the, in the King James, it's the things which belong unto thy peace, your peace. And that little pronoun, that little possessive there is missing in the earlier translations. This is one of those cases where textual criticism is kind of evenly split. You have the earlier translations going without the pronoun, and the Byzantine text, which is later but is more unified, which is the basis for King James, putting the pronoun in there. May not be a big deal, and it's kind of hard to come down one way or another. It comes up twice. In this day, I think that's it, in your day, the things which belong to peace, to your peace. So there's, I think that makes it, in a way I like that better, because it makes it more biting upon or toward the Pharisees. This is your thing, and you miss it. It's tragic. And that goes together with, you know, some of the parables he'd been telling in the previous chapters against the Pharisees. I mean, you guys are crazy. You're idiots. You're missing the point, which is precisely why he weeps, because he's inviting them and he wants them to come, but they refuse. So I think that's a big deal, especially in terms of the question of peace, because they think that their peace, or the peace that they need, is something they already have by virtue of their own religion or religious aptitude or something. And they're totally missing the point, which, of course, is the reason he weeps. And the flip side, then, of his weeping is his anger, which you see, of course, when he goes into the temple. I mean, there's a lot in here in this particular reading, and lots of ways you can go with it. So I don't know much. I haven't thought much, to be honest, about the difference in emphasis between Luke's triumphal entry, which is, not, you say, not so much of a triumph as, say, Matthew's. Mm-hmm. Hadn't really given that much thought. And I don't know what to make of that either, but I think that, in general, Luke's emphasis here and in the preceding chapters is on the blindness, or the failure of the Pharisees to understand that he actually came for them. I mean, he's always at enmity with them. They're always fighting with words. They're always arguing. You know, they hate him. They reject mm-hmm. him. They want to kill him. And he levels back very poignant and clear accusations against them, leading one possibly to think that he has nothing to do with them either. He wants to make it known that they're his avowed enemies, which of course they are, but there's also this side to it that, in fact, he came for them and they rejected him. So I think that's kind of going on in this verse 42. If you had known the things which belong to peace, or to your peace, you'd have been so much better off there. That's the implied thing there. But now they are hid from your eyes. And that's fascinating too, because he had just finished a long section of parables. And in the parables, I'm importing some Matthean idea here, that the parables were specifically given so that the proud might, that they might be opaque to the proud and open to the humble who come and ask him what they mean. So now they're hid from your eyes. Mm-hmm. You don't get it now, because you failed here. And so you're done. I think that's why he goes into then the prediction of the destruction of Jerusalem. It's going to be brutal. you guys. You're in for big trouble. And well, not just that, in the judgment, but very soon.
Yeah. And that's part of the thing with the triumphal entry too, I think, that, you know, whenever a ruler came to visit a city and they were not welcomed, whenever a ruler came to visit, let's put it that way, and they were not welcomed and, you know, with open arms by the elite of the city, the who's who, so to speak.
Yeah.
It often ends in destruction of that place.
Yeah, sure. And it sort of what you're implying here, and I think you're correct, is that he calls the people who will level the city their enemies. But it seems to be implying that those enemies of them are working on behalf of him because he was rejected. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are going to be sorry you rejected me.
Yeah.
And then in, you know, just a generation comes the destruction of Jerusalem, which, of course, is a part and parcel or a piece or a foretaste of the final judgment, all because they rejected him. Yeah. They did not know the things that belong to their peace. So there's
How much does this go back to even like, you know, the beginning of Isaiah? Was it Isaiah 8 and the pronouncements that the people in the northern kingdom are aligned with Syria? You know, they care more about, Rezin and Rephidim than they do about the Lord and his prophet.
Well, and even in the later chapters of Isaiah, he just goes on and on about what's going to happen because the Assyrians are going to come in and they're going to wipe you out. And of course they do. So that's sort of a precursor of what happens in 70. And both are precursors of what will happen in the end. We get this kind of twice, don't we, in the church here? Because there's another one coming up where the destruction of Jerusalem is referenced again. I think it's in Matthew. Isn't that coming up in, 3 or 4 weeks?
Later in Trinity, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's another opportunity to talk about this because that's when traditionally you can put in the account in, is it in Josephus, of the destruction of Jerusalem, which I always read. Because, I mean, that's a piece of...
I was going to ask you if that was for this time or for another one.
That's coming up. That's not for this time. There's so much previewing going on here. You know, this is a preview of that, and that's a preview of 70 AD, and that's a preview of the final judgment. I mean, it's very prophetic in the sense of being like the prophets who repeatedly give what you might call down payments of the coming judgment. And in fact, the whole of the Old Testament, you could even say in a wider sense, gives predictions or previews of the coming of Christ. And of course, as we've heard many times, the prophets didn't really see as clearly as we do the two comings of Christ. I mean, I think, was that book by a Nauman, Messianic Mountaintops, I think it's called. And the idea being that, you know, when you look off into the distance, you see one mountain range, and you get close to it, there's actually two ranges, one before the other. And so this is something that you see in the prophets looking ahead to what is fulfilled in Christ, and that in that also, Christ also, as the prophet par excellence, looks ahead to a destruction which is a preview of the coming final eschatological destruction, which you just can't ignore. So that's, and of course, then there's this element here in this gospel of the fact that although the judgment is coming, and vengeance is coming, and the fulfillment of the pleas of the imprecatory psalms of how the Lord will avenge his own, there is this side of it that shows his broken heart over those upon whom he must level judgment. There's a kind of a paradox there that he wants all men to be saved, and yet if they refuse, he's going to enjoy putting them down. And so are we. I mean, there's something that can't be fully explained or plumbed in that, because our understanding is limited, of course.
Yeah.
But I think that's evident.
Well, I mean, that
here.
Would be, yeah, I think that would be a good thing to kind of discuss in terms of once we get into how to preach this, you know, there's, in what way is he addressing warnings to us as well? And in what ways is he also showing what will happen to our enemies because they're his enemies? Like, how would you preach that? Do you have two separate sermons almost? Or, it seems like you could go either way. You can assume that people need to hear the warnings to know the time of their visitation. But then at the same time, it may seem like, you know, in our day, they also need to hear that in the end, God is triumphant over his enemies. And we are often caught in the crosshairs of the enemies of God.
Yeah. There's something about this particular gospel that, I mean, it's very two-sided, because here he's weeping over the city. And so in sadness, he's telling what's going to happen to it. And then he goes into the temple and suddenly he's angry and he throws him out. This does not have the making of the whip. Is that in John's gospel where he overturns their tables and makes
a whip?
That's
in John's gospel.
Yeah, that's not, this is, there are some connections between Luke and John, which I don't want to get into at this point. But in any case, there's a sharp contrast. There's like two sides of Jesus here, two sets of emotions, which are kind of flip sides of each other. One is his sadness. The other is his anger. And of course, we see it in an earthly sense in Jesus, who is very earthly because he's in the flesh. He's in his humiliation as well. So you see him weeping. His heart is broken. And yet you also see him furious. And he drives out the money changers who are in league, at least it seems in this context, with the Pharisees. And he replaces them with himself, because now he's teaching every day in the temple. And of course, this was the catalyst that ended up with his crucifixion. I mean, it's really a fascinating display.
So is this Jesus enacting the parable of the strong man versus the stronger man?
Yeah, it could be, although that's also in Matthew. I mean, it's kind of hard to stick to one gospel when you get to this, because it's evident in all, but it's clearly an indication of his two-sidedness and of understanding, therefore, the fact that his anger is in league, you might say, if I could coin a phrase, with his sorrow. They're like flip sides of the same thing. And the anger then comes as a result of the fact that the money changers were abusing his people. I mean, that's, to put it in earthly terms, that's why he's so upset. You know, first he weeps over the city, and then he gets into the city, and he goes into the temple, and he sees what they're doing, and he's just furious. Not so much to show the other side of himself, but just because he is. I mean, what are you doing? You guys had got it all wrong, and these people are suffering because of it. But den of thieves, you're stealing from the people of God. Get out of here. And he just can't help himself. He loses his temper, as it were. Well, he really does. He loses his temper. Yeah. He kicks him out. And so he's very emotional.
Well, I mean,
in the first place.
Maybe we should talk about what a den of robbers is. Because it seems to be, to me, that, you know, this terminology can sometimes be misunderstood, that they have made his house a refuge for robbers. I mean, a den of robbers is the place, is it not, where robbers go to be safe, where they retire at after their job. So could we say that when Jesus says, you've made my house, which is supposed to be a house of prayer, into a refuge and a place of safety for robbers, that they have made the temple a cloak for their illegitimate and evil schemes against the people of God.
I don't know if I'd make too much of that. I was just looking up where this comes from, and it's in Jeremiah, of course, the seventh chapter, where, in fact, this is in the 1 year in the some of the Old Testament readings that go with the 1 year series. We just had it a few weeks ago, where it's will you steal, murder, commit adultery, swear falsely, and then walk after other gods, and then come and stand before me in this house, which is called by my name, and say, we are delivered to do all these abominations. Is this house, which is called by my name, become a den of thieves in your eyes? Behold, I have seen it, says the Lord. So I think it comes from that. The warning against Judah there is being fulfilled. And of course, we know that Jeremiah's day was the day of the last days of the kingdom of Israel. And then along comes the Babylonian captivity. I don't know, the den, I hadn't thought of that, but I wouldn't make much of it, but I would just make this claim that it's, they're not only missing out, which is what you see in the first part of this reading, they're missing out on what they could have, which causes him to weep. But on top of that, they're oppressing the people who know. They're oppressing the ones who are crying out, blessed is the king that comes. They're robbing from them, which of course we know in several other pericopes was what they did.
Yeah, I guess what I was trying to get at is, throughout Jeremiah, don't the people say, in response to Jeremiah's prophecies, look, the Lord is never going to come and destroy Jerusalem. It's where his house is, right? So they feel as though they have a safety there.
I see what you're saying. Sure.
A place to hide their sins and pretend like everything is just fine so long as they're going to temple on, Saturday evening or whatever it is.
Right.
And so he's driving out these people who are stealing, but it's not just them. It's the whole lot of them that
they got it all backwards.
A den of robbers, because they're all going along with it.
Yeah, they're being an abomination. Then, I mean, this is really thick when we get to the end of this, because then they sought to destroy him. I mean, they're livid, just as angry as he is. Once he does this, he's thrown down the gauntlet, so to speak. Is that the word? He's thrown down the glove. He's thrown down the glove.
Yeah.
This is it. And they rise to the challenge. They say, okay, you've had it. And he said, no, you've had it. And then of course they kill him and he emerges alive the third day, and then come his armies. So it's the story, if you will, upon which all good stories are based, if I may say so, because the good guy gets beaten up and then he emerges victorious, which proves that what he said was the truth. It's also historical. It's not, when we talk about eschatology and the coming judgment day, we don't just have to talk about it as if, well, this is never going to happen, because it never, the days and weeks and months and years go on, sort of like, is that in 2 Peter? Everything goes on just as it was in the beginning. Well, no, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Because you can look at history, 70 AD, it actually happened. Jerusalem was wiped out and not one stone was laid upon another. I mean, it's just as he said it. And of course, our liberal friends like to say, well, this must have been inserted after 70 because it's so accurate. Of course, there's no evidence of that, but that's the whole point, that the prediction of the end and the judgment and the sweeping devastation which will come upon all the earth, it's a foregone conclusion, even as we have already in history the first installment of it, so to speak. It's already happened. This gospel then, there was another thing about it too that I was wondering about. It kind of goes together with peace, and that is the time of your visitation. And I was kind of wondering about that visitation. That doesn't appear anywhere, as I can tell, anywhere else. At the time of your episcopate, you're the
bishopric.
Parish visitor. that's pretty thick too. He's telling them mm-hmm. that he's their bishop, that he's their visitor from heaven, so to speak. Well, I don't know if he means to say that much, but it's clear that it's true. You didn't know that you're being
well.
Visited
is it
right
in
now.
Luke that? Yeah, isn't it in Luke where after his miracles they proclaim and God has visited his people, or is that also in Matthew?
That's a good question. Hadn't thought of that. Let's see what I got here. God has visited his people. Is that, I think that's in Luke. I can't remember where it is, but you're right. The spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach the gospel, but that's not, the term visitation doesn't come up there, but there is something, you're right. And I don't remember exactly where it is.
Yeah, there is a couple miracles where after they're done, the people cry out, you know, they glorify God, saying, "God has visited His people."
Yeah,
something to that effect.
I think that's in Luke, but I'm not sure. It's the same idea, really, as the idea of their peace. And of course, I think it's helpful in preaching as well to make abundantly clear what we mean by peace. Mm-hmm. It's not just, you know, good feeling that everything's all right. It's the end of warfare.
Yeah,
it's the fact
it's coming up for us.
How's that?
Mm-hmm.
It's what?
It's Luke 7. It's the raising of the widow's son at Nain.
Oh, God has visited his people. Yeah. But this peace is accomplished by the peacemaker, which, of course, there I go again in Matthew. But peace is the end of warfare, the end of enmity between heaven and earth. And, of course, there are opportunities to point out that this term appears also in the liturgy of the divine service. You know, the peace of the Lord be with you always, right after the consecration. And and then when you receive the sacrament, depart in peace. And then at the close of the service, and give you peace. So there's plenty of opportunity, and there's peace, of course, in the beginning too, at the Gloria. So there's plenty of opportunities to talk about peace and precisely what that means. Heaven's peace has come to earth, and now the peace that has come to earth causes there to be peace between man and heaven, without any participation on the part of the people except for the peacemaker, Christ himself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's an opportunity to get real Lutheran here, you know, because...
which I'm sure you love.
Which is always a good thing. What's fascinating, too, about this description of the destruction, they shall lay you even with the ground and your children within you. I mean, that's like the flood. That's fulfillment of the commandments, the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. There's nothing left. That is the destruction of people who were told, either in the case of by Moses or by Joshua, or sometimes a city was to be wiped out and nothing left of it. And Saul, as I recall, got in trouble when he didn't do that. Because these are also prolepsies or down payments or previews of the judgment day in which nobody will escape, no matter who you are. You know, that doesn't matter if you're a child or an adult, you won't escape without the peace that is brought to earth and which Christ brings then to heaven on our behalf. So there's a lot there, and it's... What's fascinating is that it's all about the enmity between Jesus and the Pharisees. I mean, this isn't about the people, except for the people who came to listen to him. It's about the great fight between Jesus and his enemies. That's what's in view in this particular gospel. Of course, it's for the sake of the people, which show up at the end. The people were very attentive to hear him. And that's another theme in Luke, you know, that the people gathered around him because of what he said. Well, it's also in Matthew. And then comes chapter 20.
Here's my question for you. You know, you had talked about how, on the one hand, you have Jesus's great sadness, and then you have his anger against those who had rejected him, and behind that, of course, is they're plotting to destroy him and to destroy anyone who is associated with him or who believes or trusts in him, which we see later in Acts. But I'm curious about this particular phrase in verse 44, and tear you down to the ground. So that word tear you down, that is the same word used in Psalm 137 and the casting of your infants upon the rocks.
Oh yeah.
And
oh, yeah.
So I'm curious if you have
little ones at least, against the stones.
It's the same word in the Septuagint. Yeah, yeah. So and you have your children within you. So I'm curious if you have within that anger a certain imprecation going on that could be preached in a sermon on this to the people of God, that God is going to be dealing with his enemies. Because if they're his enemies, they're our enemies.
Well, and that brings me back to what you said, which I would alter just a little bit. He's weeping over their rejection of him, but then he becomes angry. Mm-hmm. I think this is at least implied, not so much that they have rejected him, but that they're abusing his people. You know, they're abusing the people who come to the temple, and instead of instead of having prayer there, what the house of prayer is supposed to be for, they get robbed. And this, of course, is a repeated theme throughout Scripture, that if you want to understand God's anger, you need to understand his love, because he becomes angry precisely because he loves his people and he won't tolerate or abide abuses to them. That's the whole point of the judgment. It's a vindication of his people. It's not just because he happens to be an angry God, you know, and they're just, well, you didn't accept me, I've had it with you. It's because they abused his people. And clearly, I think in this setting,
his people. I guess that's my question to you, particularly on this den of robbers things. I mean, robbers don't rob in their dens. That's where they find sanctuary. That's where they find their safety. And so on the one hand, I don't discount that the tax exchange that was going on there was, you know, awful and was against his people. But, you know, these are his people doing this to his people. And they're making the temple their, it's like their shell corporation to make it look like it's okay. And saying, well, this is, you know, this is the temple and this is how it works. And we're just doing what we're supposed to do.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that what ignites his wrath here, his earthly wrath, his anger, is the fact that they are selling and buying, and that the people to whom they're buying and selling are being cheated out of the prayers of the church. I mean, that's the way I read it. That fits with why he suddenly gets so irate. You know, it's one thing. It's kind of like when it's not like the Good Samaritan. I was going to say I don't have a demon, but you dishonor God. I'm thinking of how what just really ignited his anger was the way they were treating the people. That they were his people themselves, truly, and he weeps over that. But it's quite another thing for them to be abusing the ones who are the poor, who are coming for help. The ones who had cried out peace in heaven and glory in the highest just before.
Sure, but how does that square with, say, the verse 44 when he says, and, you know, tear you down to the ground, you and your children within you? Because it seems like the anger is already there. It's like he's the Hulk and he's ready to come out. He's sad,
I guess. Yeah,
but he's recognizing that his people are far away from him, and
you guys are going to be running for cover.
and the very things that they prayed for in the Psalms for the Babylonians are now going to be visited upon you because of what you have done to me.
True. And there is a specific reference to the other people, and that's in the last verse here, the people who are very attentive to hear him. You know, they're the they're the ones who are the victims of all this. And, I mean, maybe that's not as overt to you as it is to me, but it's easy to preach that, to explain the reason for his anger being the abuse of his poor ones. I mean, that really gets him going. I mean, it's one thing if you reject me, but it's another thing if you cause others to commit adultery, so to speak. That's what really sets me off.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
This is Ezekiel too, isn't it? That the very job of these people is to call them to account, not to just go along with things.
Yeah. There's another thing about what he says to them, which I'm wondering, because both according to the translation you read and according to the King James, it says in verse 46, my house is the house of prayer. But I see in the Greek the future tense, my house shall be a house of prayer. So I'm wondering, is there an alternate reading that we're getting?
Well, that is what I read.
It is? Shall be?
The version I read has shall, yes.
Oh, my version only.
My house shall be a house of prayer.
Okay. I don't know. I don't know why. Must be an alternate reading.
Well, and the interesting thing, too, is this is a quote from Isaiah 56. And what is left off is for all peoples.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So the Gentiles are included.
Well, they shall be included. I mean, there's the future sense of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if you could make anything of that or not, but the fact that his...
Well, I wonder, let's just think this through a little bit. If he is getting rid of the money changers, that means he's getting rid of the coin for the temple, which means you don't have to have a particular coin to worship there.
Oh,
right. You don't have to be, you don't have to meet a certain standard, the way like that.
You don't have to be circumcised. Just come in.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've often wondered about whether we should make more about the house itself, the temple. You know, it's not just a synagogue here we're talking about, the temple, which is itself a representation of his flesh, of his body, as we know from John. But when you look at it is the second temple, which wasn't as beautiful as the first, but still it was pretty big deal. The temple was this ornate, beautiful, gold, gilded, it's had all these pomegranates and everything. It was just absolutely outstandingly gorgeous. And I take that as a picture of what the body of Christ truly is. His flesh is the flesh of God. It's infused, so to speak, with divinity. If we can say that. That's, you know, what do they call it? The genus majestaticum. that's what we learned in seminary. That is, it is the body of Christ is the body of God. And it doesn't look that way, especially here as he's coming into Jerusalem. He's about to be crucified. But the temple stands as a visual indicator of what his house, his body, really is. I don't know if he can make much of that or not, but I mean, it's fascinating. You can always talk about the temple. You know, there's much that can be said about the temple, and especially the first temple, because, in fact, I teach this often in catechism, that there's a great difference between, I don't want to get too far afield, but there's a great difference between David and Solomon. David was the war king. Solomon was the prince of peace, and there was peace in his days, and there was also the temple. David wanted to build a temple. God didn't let him. And he has to fight all these battles. And the fighting is over when you get to Solomon, and there's also a temple. So the temple itself, being at first the building that Solomon built and then rebuilt, or they rebuilt, I would say it in a way as a symbol of the resurrection, if you want to get into that history, the temple is destroyed, the temple is rebuilt. So that when he says, destroy this temple and I'll rebuild it, they know about the destruction and rebuilding of the temple. That the temple itself is an indication of precisely what God plans to do. And maybe that's in the background here, because it's not just the synagogue, it's the temple.
Yeah. Is there any connection to, what is it, Luke 2, when he says, did you not know I must be among the things of my father? It's often translated as father's house, but the word for temple is not there, or house is not there, but he means the temple. Is there a difference between calling it my father's house, and now he's really referring to it as my house?
Well, I was just noticing quoting that too. And also Isaiah. We should remember too, that's right. We should remember too that in Luke in particular, there's a lot to be said about liturgical worship and the temple. I mean, at the end of the gospel, after the ascension, they go back there and in great joy, they go back to the temple. So whereas in Matthew, they go out into all the world, in Luke, they go back to the temple. And there's, you know, we have the temple in the beginning when John's father goes in and has the vision. There's just a lot to be said throughout this gospel about the temple. So now you have the abuse of the temple, which you could even say is emblematic of the abuse they will give to Christ's body. I suppose you could make much of that connection, because the temple is always a symbol of the incarnation. It's a picture of, it's the place where God dwells. He's there. Well, it's a picture of where he is. He's not just there in reality, but it's a picture of his. They all knew that he wasn't only in the Holy of Holies, that he was everywhere, but they also knew that in a special way, he was there in the Holy of Holies, in the temple. So there would have to be some recognition that the temple is a real special indicator in some way of God's presence. That as God is present within the temple, and the temple is therefore a thing of beauty, the house with the beautiful gate, that's a wonderful portrayal of what Christ is in the flesh, the temple of God. So I don't know if we want to get off.
Is there any significance to the fact that, say, when Solomon builds the temple and he wants to know how he know that God will dwell there because he's so big, how great thou art and all. Is there any significance to the fact that he says, well, I will put my name there and then that's how you'll know that I'll dwell there. Could we carry this over then not only to how Jesus is the dwelling of God, but now in baptism, right, we have God's name upon us, and where God's name is, there he is. So is there any carryover there that we should be mindful of, not to make our own bodies a den of robbers?
Sure, you could. That's a springboard right there that you can talk about, you know, the importance of living a Christian life. as temple of the Holy Ghost. Mm-hmm. I love thinking about this, though, this idea of the temple. There's something I never quite figured out about the second temple. It's the same thing that the old priests couldn't figure out and why they wept when the second temple was built. It was really nothing compared to the first one. And if it's a symbol of the resurrection, which I kind of think it is, why is that? Well, is it that the image kind of always tends to break down? It's never a perfect image. There might be something more than that, but I've never figured it out. I mean, this whole history is a fascinating depiction of God's revelation. There's even, I haven't got into this too much. There's even some people say that if you look at the temple from above, you can almost see a man. There's the head, which is in the Holy of Holies. You have the arms, which are the rooms along the side. And then you have the two pillars, Boaz and Jabin, or the other one. They're the legs. I mean, I don't want to make too much of that, but it's kind of a fascinating theory.
But I'm sure that we will hear this referenced in your next sermon.
I don't know about that. Well, I brought it up in Bible class, and you know, people just kind of scratch their head. I don't know what to do with it.
Okay, Pastor.
Yeah, right, exactly. You go, girl. I mean,
whatever. They lean over to each other and say, "Has he taken his meds?"
Yeah, exactly. Now, before we get too far off of this, I think there's something else that we might have missed, and that is right before this gospel, you have the Pharisees telling Jesus to rebuke his disciples, and then he says, if they should hold their peace, they should, well, be silent. I don't think the word peace is actually there. The stones would cry out. And then at the end of this pericope, there's the people being very attentive to hear him. Like, far from rebuking them, I'm going to rebuke you. Get out of their way. Get out of my way. I'm busy with these people. I need to teach them. That's why I've come, to be mm-hmm. their teacher. And I won't tolerate people getting in the way of that. And I love this image of what really makes him angry. I mean, I've probably said that about 4 or 5 times in this hour, but I think it's an important point to make. He's not just an angry judge sitting on a rainbow, as Luther used to think before he was converted. His anger has a purpose. It's his love. Mm. You know, it's like Psalm 18, where you're crying out, David's crying out, and he heard my cry from his heaven, and he rode upon a cherub and did fly. He flew upon the wings of the wind. He comes down, and his anger burns. Well, he's not mad at me. He's mad at the reason for which I cried out. Mm-hmm. And that's just such a compelling image. I think it needs to be brought out.
Yeah. I think it's also compelling that he's no longer withdrawing after this point, right? He is teaching daily in the temple, almost like, come get me.
Yeah.
Come and take it.
X marks the spot.
Yeah.
And they do. I mean, this supposedly happened on the day after Palm Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. So every day of Holy Week, he's teaching him in the temple. And then he gets sacrificed in the temple, so to speak, or near the temple, cast out, which is a very Levitical thing, too, which is kind of key to Luke.
Yeah.
Well, there's much more that can be said. I mean...
So what are you going to? What are you? Yeah, what are you going to preach on? What are you going to focus on?
I'll probably be saying quite a bit about peace, I think, because mm-hmm. I've been pondering that lately, and the way in which that word just pops up all over the place, both in Luke's gospel and in the liturgy, in the divine service, it's just all over the place, and people hear the word so much that it tends to just roll off the tongue and, yeah, okay, peace, very nice, without really understanding what that means. It's not something that was easily achieved. Here comes the peacemaker. This needs to be accomplished for you, this peace. And it goes back to it's interesting that it's Jeremiah that's being fulfilled here, because mm-hmm. what happened when Jeremiah said these things, look what they did to him. They threw him in a pit, in a dungeon. They really abused him. Mm-hmm. And then along comes the Babylonians and wipes out the city and destroys the temple, just like in 70. And I don't know if much can be made of this or not, but they left some poor people behind when they carried away all the captives. They left some poor people behind to tend to this, to the crops or something. Nothing is usually made of that fact, but the very fact that it's Jeremiah that's being fulfilled here is indicative of Jesus as the greater Jeremiah too. Because look what they're going to do to him, and the temple's destroyed because of what they did to him. Because he was destroyed, and in 3 days he built the temple, and now the old temple, the picture of his reality is now passé. It's no longer needed, so it's done away. The whole of Israel, behold, your house is left unto you desolate. This is, you're done for. Don't need you anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going out into the highways and hedges. My wedding hall will be filled. I mean, this is borrowing from all over the place, but it's what's happening here. So there you are.
Well, good. Thank you for your time, Fritz. I look forward to having you on again.
I look forward to it. It's fun. Thanks. Mm-hmm.